Very good morning to you, and thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva today, Friday the 12th of June. Another important agenda for you. We have a colleague who will be joining us momentarily from Port-au-Prince in Haiti, the UN women representative. We will connect with her shortly. We have a short change to the agenda. So we're going to start with our colleagues from the World Health Organization and UNICEF to speak to the situation of Ebola. We also have Tarek with us, as well as Dr. Oladapo, from WHO, who's going to speak to the situation of maternal and perinatal health. And we also have announcements from the ILO and from UNAIDS. So let's start right away with our colleagues on the podium with me. I'm very pleased to have Dr. Douglas Noble, who is UNICEF's Global Lead for Public Health, Emergencies, and Global Incident Manager for Ebola, who I'll go to immediately, and then we'll go to our colleague in the field. So over to you, Doctor.
Great, thank you very much, and welcome the opportunity to be here this morning.
Okay. Thank you for having me here this morning on behalf of UNICEF. I have just come in from Bunia in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and what I saw there stays with you. The first thing that hits you is the context. Eastern DRC has endured years of conflict. Many children and families have been displaced. Hospitals and clinics are often short on supplies. People are constantly on the move, fleeing violence, following mining routes, seeking services, which makes surveillance and response especially difficult. And the situation of children is particularly challenging. In Ituri, by way of context, more than half of children under five are chronically malnourished. More than one in five are zero-dose children, which means they have never received their first dose of the basic diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine. That's a proxy for limited access to healthcare. The point is, these are already very vulnerable children. So the capacity for this community to absorb any additional stressors was already stretched to breaking point. Then Ebola arrived. Past Ebola outbreaks in this region have shown what this can mean for children. They have in the past made up a significant share of cases and an even greater share of deaths, with the youngest facing the highest fatality rates, and many left orphaned or separated from caregivers. During my recent visit to Rumpara Hospital in Bunia, at the epicenter of the outbreak, health workers told me people had stopped coming in for routine care because they were afraid. But when families stop seeking care, children miss vaccinations and illnesses go untreated, and the outbreak starts costing lives not just by Ebola, but by things it never directly touched. As of 11 June, the DRC has reported 676 confirmed cases and 136 confirmed deaths. Most cases to date have been among socially and economically active adults, but as the outbreak evolves, we must be prepared for increasing household transmission, which means we may see more children affected in the days ahead. Early symptoms in children: fever, diarrhea, vomiting, tiredness, and loss of appetite are hard to tell apart from other diseases, such as malaria, which is common in Ituri. So precious time can be lost before Ebola is even suspected. And for the Bundibugyo species, there is no approved vaccine or specific treatment beyond supportive care. That means preparedness, infection prevention and control, and building community understanding and trust are our frontline tools. And that trust can't be taken for granted. A recent UNICEF U Report survey of 50,000 young people in the DRC found that two-thirds were not aware how Ebola spreads or how to protect themselves, about one in five didn't believe the disease is real, and nearly a third would not welcome a survivor back into their community. When I was in one of the hospitals, I was told there was a body in a nearby displacement camp and the community were not yet ready to give it up. Dialogue between the health professionals and the community were underway, but it was a reminder to me that building shared understanding and trust is essential. And that's why UNICEF works with the World Health Organization and partners to prioritize community engagement, understanding, education, and ownership in health systems. Our six-month response plan targets 3.7 million people. We have already delivered 150 metric tons of supplies to Bunia, trained and deployed more than 1,600 community health workers and mobilizers and 24 decontamination teams, and reached over 160,000 households as of yesterday. We're also establishing nurseries in facilities close to Ebola treatment centers. These are safe spaces where children can be cared for while their parents are treated. And our first creche opens in Bunia in the coming days. The need for that type of support is real. Our staff on the ground were told of a family in which the grandmother, father, and mother died from Ebola, leaving a week-old baby who is now being closely monitored. The outbreak has also crossed into Uganda, where 19 confirmed cases and two deaths have been reported. Uganda remains at risk, particularly along the 800-kilometer porous border between the two countries, and we are supporting with partners the national response across 37 high-risk districts, including refugee hosting areas, border districts, and Greater Kampala. Let me finish by saying that we can spare children the worst of this outbreak. Fast detection, strong pediatric care, monitoring of contacts, and communities that are informed and engaged can help bring this outbreak under control. What we now need are the resources, humanitarian access, and the trust of communities to succeed. We are appealing for $70.7 million over the next 6 months, of which $17.4 remains unfunded, and that's part of the broader continental response plan led by the World Health Organization and Africa CDC. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Dr. Noble, for that very clear and important update. Now I'm going to turn to our colleague in the field who's joining us from Beni in North Kivu, Dr. Olivier Lepolin, who's the unit head of epidemiology and analytics for response of the WHO. So thank you very much for joining us, Doctor. Over to you.
Thank you, and thanks for having me this morning. I'm connecting from Beni, as you said, in North Kivu, after 3 weeks on the ground here. And I just want to tell you a little bit more about the situation, complementing what Douglas has provided already as context. Also look at some of the gaps in what we're doing to support the government response. So we see the outbreak continues to expand, both in terms of case numbers, but also in terms of geographic spread. As mentioned already, as of yesterday, 676 cases, confirmed cases have been reported, and 136 deaths. The vast majority of those cases are in Ituri province, but with cases now identified in 34 different health zones across Ituri, North Kivu, and South Kivu provinces. Almost every day, cases are being identified in new health zones. And that reflects really the scale of this outbreak, a scale that is much bigger than what is being detected, and the high mobility of the population in this part of the DRC. We've been working with the government on a risk prioritization of health zones to tailor interventions to the risk and to the scale of the outbreak in those health zones. For example, 17 health zones right now are qualified as hotspots, requiring more support compared to zones with only one or two cases. The prioritization also identifies, importantly, a number of areas of very high risk where there's not yet reporting of cases, but we identify those areas as high risk based on where they're located and the mobility pattern of the population from hotspot zones to those areas, and especially in those areas where surveillance needs to be strengthened. Speaking more broadly, we know what the key drivers are of epidemics like Ebola and what needs to be done. Safe and dignified burials, reducing the risk of infection in healthcare facilities, a big challenge in a context like the Kivus and Ituri, where you've got a very large network of formal and informal healthcare facilities. We need to be able to isolate and provide care for patients very early on in their disease course. That's good not only to reduce infection in the community, but importantly, to improve the chances of survival. We also need to strengthen surveillance and contact tracing, and to do so, engage communities, as been mentioned already. But given the size and the scale of this outbreak and the high population mobility, which is one of the defining features of the epidemiology in this outbreak, coupled with a very weakened health system and ongoing security, these are all challenges that we will need to address in the context of this response collectively. But there is no knowledge, and I've seen it firsthand in Beni over the last few days. There is knowledge and expertise in Ebola control. They've had those outbreaks in the past. There's still a lot of capacity from the outbreak that happened in 2018, 2019. We know people, healthcare workers, public health professionals know what to do. It's a matter of capacitating the teams further, ensuring they've got the right materials, right supplies, right logistics, but also the right human resources to be able to tackle the challenge right now. Having said all that, there are still many blind spots in some areas that are high risk. We know those areas are high risk based on where they are located, the mobility of population to those, and surveillance really needs to be strengthened in those areas. Likewise, the full scale of the outbreak is not yet clear, and we'll get more clarity as surveillance improves, as testing improves. For example, in Beni yesterday, the lab really has been put in place with a throughput of more than 500 tests per day. That will really help get clarity about the scale of the outbreak in Beni as well. And then we'll need to learn more. We need to learn more about the epidemiological and clinical features of the virus. There's only been two Bundibugyo outbreaks so far. And so we will learn through this outbreak whether there's also some differences in addition to the lack of course, treatment and vaccines, but some differences in the epidemiology and clinical presentation compared to other Ebola outbreaks. We continue as WHO with partners to really support the government in most pillars of the response, including expanding surveillance in terms of workforce, in terms of supporting with analysis supplies, with laboratory capacity, with logistics, importantly also with community engagement with partners, as already mentioned by Douglas, IPC and a number of other areas. But importantly, we are implementing a decentralized approach, and that is really the government's approach to this outbreak, leveraging the public health infrastructure in DRC, leveraging the capacity you've got at the zonal level, and being able to augment that with a tailored response. And with all that, skilled risk communication is extremely important. No outbreak will come under control if there's no appropriate community engagement, risk communication, and have the communities on board. So overall, the outbreak is expanding. Both geographically and in terms of number of cases, there are many blind spots, but we are seeing the elements of the response coming into place, and we'll continue to collectively strengthen this response. Thanks so much.
Thanks to you, Olivier, and of course, again, to Douglas. So we'll take questions for both of our guests, starting with you, Christiane, of the German news agency. Go ahead.
Thank you, Rolando. Could you please repeat the latest figures and where they come from, including maybe if you have the number of contacts that are being traced now? Thank you.
Maybe Olivier, if you want to take that.
Sure. I don't have the latest SITREP in front of my eyes. So in terms of numbers, we've got 676 cases. We've got 136 deaths. These span an area from Aru in the north to Miti Muresa in the south, so it's over 1,000 kilometers. And we have more than 34 health zones affected as of yesterday. So those health zones continue to expand with new areas in North Kivu also reported yesterday. In terms of contact tracing, it's improving. It's below what would be ideal and what would be expected, but it's been improving over the last few weeks. We now are just over 70% in terms of the contacts that are being appropriately traced. That's a huge improvement from where we were about a week or two ago, but it's still too low to ensure appropriate control. Thank you.
Thanks to you. Very well noted. Okay, next question, AFP.
Thank you. A couple of questions for Olivier and then also a few in the room. Olivier, if these cases are now popping up in new health zones, are they spreading only through movement, or is there something else going on that you're not yet aware of? And secondly, just an overall view, do you have anywhere near the tools that you need to be able to fight this outbreak? And then secondly, on children, do you have disaggregated figures for how many children have been confirmed as cases and have died? And secondly, when you say that you must be prepared for this to start spreading through households to children, does that mean that it's something that that you're expecting, or just something that we need to be cautious about? Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Okay, we'll start with you, Olivier.
Thank you, and it's an excellent question. So we're not only seeing cases spread because they've traveled from the hotspots right now. That was most of the feature that we saw over the last few weeks. But we also see local community spread in new areas. Benny's one example right now. We've got some cases with travel links to Bunia and to Mongwalu, the hotspots. We also have cases that have been identified in Beni with no clear link to travel to those areas. Investigations are ongoing, but the hypothesis is that there are bigger outbreaks going on already in many of those health zones that will only be picked up and detected when surveillance is fully up to scale. So it's a mix. Clearly, the mobility from the initial areas of hotspots has played an important role, but we have already outbreaks that, despite small numbers, look like they've have been somewhat established. And so that is why we need that decentralization, ensuring that we've got that capacity, ensuring that we've got treatment and care providers to confirm cases in the various health zones, but also importantly have laboratory capacity and surveillance capacity. In terms of, you know, the tools and what needs to be done, there's a lot more that needs to be done. I think across the board, more supplies to ensure that we've got safe spaces to isolate patients. Surveillance can scale up, but if you don't have any space to put your patients safely, it becomes very difficult. So all of that chain needs to be linked. The lab needs to be linked with the surveillance. The healthcare capacity needs to be linked with the surveillance. One of our big challenges right now is rapidly scale up the bed capacity. We see that with the outbreak and the direction it's going at, we will need more beds that we have right now. We have about 250 beds for isolation right now across the provinces. That is insufficient. And likewise, we need more capacity when it comes to the isolation of suspected patients who yet need to be confirmed. But as surveillance scales up, you will have many more of those, and that they can be safely isolated in the health facilities that have the standard of care required for those patients. So a lot more needs to be done. It's moving ahead, but it will need to further shift gears.
Yeah, thank you for that question. On the disaggregated data for children under the age of 18, maybe just first to caveat that by saying that the data context has been very uncertain. As you know, this was going on for a few weeks before we came to the first confirmed case. There were backlogs of samples, and there are still deaths that are being investigated. We've done some preliminary analysis, which would indicate that around 14 to 17% of cases are in children, but I'm not really in a position to say more than that at this stage. We are hoping in the days ahead to be able to release more specific data on the exact effects on children, the symptoms in children, the mortality rates in children, but I don't have any more on that at this moment in time. In terms of household spread, again, given the uncertain context and the data uncertainties, we're working based on experience from previous outbreaks. And if you look at the trends so far, we're seeing many young adults affected who are socially and economically active. Now, the number of cases are definitely going to rise more. And as we see that very active group being more in communities, we may expect to see more transmission within households, which we know can then affect children more. So to answer your question, yes, we are expecting it, and we are taking steps in our interventions to with partners and to support government to respond to that. Just maybe one last thing on the tools, and I agreed with Olivier on that. In addition to the space needed, let me just say for a moment something about the importance of humanitarian access. Some of my team this week have not been able to do their job because they cannot get access to where they need to go. So humanitarian access and cessation to violence in the region is absolutely essential to being able to deploy resources and for humanitarian workers to be able to respond. A considerable amount of attention is needed to that area by the international community.
Absolutely. Thank you, Douglas, for mentioning that. And just to remind you, colleagues, our peacekeeping colleagues, MONUSCO, are obviously deployed in the region, as they have been for many, many years now, and they're providing critical logistical assistance for the rapid delivery of medical supplies, in particular to Bunia. So this is an important angle to this crisis, of course. So let's take questions online. We have Emma of Reuters. Go ahead, Emma.
Hello, good morning from Nairobi. A question for Dr. Le Poulin, please, or two. How do you calculate the death toll? Does it only include bodies that were tested? And does the data come exclusively from hospitals? And is that a limitation? And secondly, the CDC has given projections for the scale of the outbreak, saying that it could be worse than the 2014-16 outbreak in West Africa. What are the WHO's projections at this stage?
Olivier, thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks so much. Two very important questions. When it comes to, first, let me start with deaths. These are not just hospital deaths. So it's really important to have to be able to ensure that we've got surveillance in the community. And that's one of the key elements right now, especially at this stage of the outbreak, when things are not fully in place and we still see patients coming very late and sadly, a number of community deaths. So the approach to surveillance is ensuring that they've got safe and dignified burials for all those deaths and swabbing and testing of those deaths. So they're accounted in the death toll. It's not only hospital deaths. And the focus on ensuring that there's strengthened surveillance for community deaths is really important at this stage of the outbreak. We know the risk presented by burial practices and funerals when they're not safe. And we know the challenge that can pose in terms of the outbreak spread and also derailing an outbreak. So very important to focus on that. And the deaths are certainly coming from the community as well and will need to be strengthened in terms of surveillance. When it comes to the numbers, a few things to say there. We've seen the model from the CDC with projections over a few months. I think one thing to say first is that the parameters upon which those models are being built are still fairly limited right now. So any model would be based on scenarios. Importantly, when it comes to Ebola, there's an element of clustering, which is really important. We can't assume that the outbreak will spread homogeneously in a population. It is, and all Ebola outbreaks have seen that there is an element of local and community clustering, and that will need to be taken into account in projections, potentially taking some of those numbers down if you were to do that. On our end, we haven't made firm projections. What we really are working on right now is scenarios and bed capacity. We know the bed capacity will need to increase. We also are working right now on the data we have to better understand the epidemiological parameters. So the delay distributions, to be specific, so how much cases are being delayed, what is the growth rate in the community, what is the growth rate in Bunia, what is the growth rate in Rampara. With those parameters, we can then make some assumptions about what we need in the next few weeks in terms of bed capacity. That is the focus right now of the projections we're working on. I don't have numbers to provide you at the moment, but what we know is that our bed capacity right now is too little compared to where the epidemiology is heading and will need to be scaled up quite rapidly.
Thank you, Olivier. Before we go to you, John, let me just go back to Emma. I think you have a follow-up.
I actually forgot to pose my question to UNICEF. It was on children and school. Are you seeing parents that are withholding their children from school because they're afraid of them being infected? And on what scale? Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Emma, for that question and your good reporting during the week. We're not specifically seeing that in our current social listening and engagement with communities. We are seeing some fear on behalf of children going to school. Schools have remained open. Ebola is a very different disease in terms of transmission routes to COVID. Schools can stay open. There's no reason for a school to close. Infection prevention and control measures do have to be taken, and there does have to be education within the school, amongst the teachers and the staff and amongst the children. But we're not seeing parents withholding at this moment in time, but we are picking up fear from children themselves, and that's certainly an area that we're seeking to engage in.
Thanks so much, Douglas. Okay, we'll take a question from John from The Lancet. Go ahead, John.
Good morning. My question is taking the opportunity of Dr. Noble being with us to ask you, sir, today a major report came out by UNAIDS which shows that children living with AIDS account for, with HIV, account for 3% of the total caseloads, but account for 11% of deaths. And the number of children on ARV treatment is far below that of adults. What is UNICEF's answer to this big gap, and what are you doing about it? And secondly, with cutbacks in aid funds, have your programs on prevention been affected, especially in conflict zones? Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I have not seen that report released today yet, so I cannot give you a specific answer. We can refer you to our colleagues in HIV/AIDS to answer those questions. What I would say with regard to the current Ebola outbreak is that we are seeking to respond to all vulnerable groups in the communities, both children and adults, including those infected with HIV/AIDS. So that's certainly a priority for us. In terms of funding gaps, thank you for raising that. In a general sense, there, as we know, there were many funding cuts and gaps last year. Inevitably, that has affected many development and humanitarian programs and the international assistance available across the board, not just for the Ebola outbreak, but of course for many other needs, including in HIV/AIDS prevention and response.
Thank you very much, Douglas. John, that's an issue that we are going to address later on in this briefing. I think in terms of the Ebola questions, I don't see any more hands up online or in the room. So on this note, I'd like to thank you very much, Douglas, Olivier, very much for joining us here. Important updates, of course, and we'll continue to spotlight this situation. Thank you as well, Ricardo. And I think, Tarek, you're going to stay on, or maybe you might as well. So thank you again, Doctor. Okay, now I understand we have our guest from Port-au-Prince who is connected, and I think you could hear us, Marie Goretti Ndewayo. Just want to make sure you can definitely hear us.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, and I appreciate it's really early in the morning. I believe it's 5 o'clock in the morning in Haiti. Just to introduce you, you are UN Women's Representative in Haiti, and you're going to provide an update on the situation of women and girls in the context of the situation in Haiti. So thank you again very much. Over to you for your brief.
Thank you so much. Good morning, ladies, gentlemen, colleagues. The opening of Haiti's first state-supported safe house, known as Women's House for Survivors of Violence, is a woman of hope and a painful reminder of the dangers that women and girls face here. On the ground, I'm hearing from women and girls that rape is being increasingly used as a tool by the gangs to terrorize and control communities. We can see this is in data. In 2025, the United Nations Integrated Office in Haiti, BINU, verified 1,863 cases of sexual violence. This includes 1,668 women, 187 girls, 2 men, and 6 boys, and represent a 163% increase compared with 2024. During the first 3 months of this year, sexual violence accounted for more than 70% of reported gender-based violence cases. There are also reports of digital technologies and platforms being used by perpetrators to preserve image of sexual assault to extort or further humiliate victims. Gang violence, once concentrated in here in Port-au-Prince, is now spreading across the country, forcing nearly 1.48 million people from their homes, including 790 women and girls. Women and girls living in displacement sites face some of the highest level of vulnerability. A UN Women report finds that gender-based violence was reported in all 22 sites that we surveyed. Most displacement sites don't have adequate lighting. Most of most do not have functioning locks in bathroom or separate facilities for women and men. These conditions put women and girls at further risk of violence. We are also seeing that dedicated service for survivors are extremely limited, including psychosocial and legal support, which remain largely unavailable. The mental health toll has been so huge that women repeatedly tell me that they no longer recognize their lives. The violence that they survived followed them every day and every night, even as they sleep. Their memories are of their houses being burnt down or guns following them into the forest, of families, members, and friends killed in front of them. Mothers have told me how they used to grow fruits and vegetables, run small businesses, and generate income that their families relied on. Today, extortion at illegal checkpoint of gang-controlled roads, repetitive kidnapping, and sexual violence have left women and girls fearing for their safety and leaving them unable to even take part in daily life. At the same time, the pressure of women have increased immensely. Before displacement, most women had some form of income-generating activities, often through informal trade or small businesses. Today, only a fraction has access to these opportunities. In displacement sites, our data show that more than 80% of women are unemployed. Yet, it's women who continue to take care of most household responsibilities and expenses. We have also witnessed a complete deterioration in access to healthcare, education, safe water, and sanitation. More than 1,600 schools have been forced to close. Nearly 30% of health facilities in Port-au-Prince are no longer functioning. Alongside immense suffering, women are increasingly leading local humanitarian peace and security efforts. An example of this is in increased participation in displacement site committees from just 2% in September 2024 to more than 40% in 2025. Women's organizations are supporting survivors of violence, providing cash transfer, helping families access services and the basics, and strengthening protection, participation, prevention, and recovery within communities. UN Women support these organizations and is working with the state and UN entities to provide life-saving support to women and girls and help them rebuild their lives. The opening of Haiti's first state-supported safe house, led by the Minister of Women's Welfare and Women's Rights, with support of UN Women, is an important milestone in the response to gender-based violence specifically. But the needs are growing, and international aid to Haiti has collapsed. Women and girls urgently need expanded gender-based violence prevention and response services, increased food and cash assistance, access to health care and education, support to rebuild livelihoods, and increased funding for women-led organizations on the front line of the response. The women and girls of Haiti have shown incredible resilience, but this resilience alone cannot be the answer. Women and girls in Haiti need safety and protection, and they need the international community to respond. I thank you.
Thanks very much to you. Very, very important brief. We're very happy to connect with you to share this situation as difficult as it is. So let's take questions in the room. We have AFP for you.
Thank you. On the safe houses, how many of these safe houses are there, and what's their sort of capacity and their facilities? And secondly, in this very volatile environment, how can the women who need those services feel reassured about their safety in those safe houses? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. The women houses are designed as integrated service center, providing comprehensive support to survivors of gender-based violence. The first of four facilities include dormitories, receptions and counseling areas, and infirmary, recreation space, a cafeteria, and a dedicated child-friendly space for survivors. In addition, survivors will have access to a range of essential services, including legal assistance, medical care, psychosocial support, case management, refer to specialized services, livelihood support as exist strategies, and information on their rights, and of course, available protection mechanisms. Of course, the first of the four safe houses opened in Port-au-Prince at the end of May. Three more will open in other departments, location impacted by growing gang violence, the department of the center, Artibonite and Grandance, which are the four main areas which are affected. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, further questions in the room or online? No, I don't see that's the case. So, Ms. Nduwayo, thank you so very much for briefing us. This is an immensely important brief, and we'll do what we can to spread the word. And thank you again for especially joining us so early in the morning, and we really appreciate it. So thanks very much, and you and
it's
women
colleagues.
Thank you so much, and you and women colleagues will of course share the notes of Ms. Nduwayo. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, we're going back to WHO, and very pleased. Tarek, you want to introduce our guest here? Yes, go ahead.
Thanks, Orlando. Just before that, we shared the notes of Dr. Olivier Lepolon. So you have those notes with you in your email. Really happy to have Dr. Femi Oladapo with us. It's not his first time at the Palais speaking to you, but he told me the last time was many, many years ago. So he will tell us more about a new WHO and Lancet series of postpartum hemorrhage. And Dr. Femi is head of maternal and perinatal health unit at WHO. You also got his opening remarks. There's also a press release that will be shared with you shortly as it is being published together with the document itself. Dr. Femi.
Thank you very much, Tarek. Good morning, all. And thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. I'm here to share with you a new blueprint to end one of the deadliest complications of pregnancy, that is excessive bleeding after birth. Every 12 minutes, somewhere in the world, a woman dies of excessive bleeding after childbirth. Many of these women have survived many things. They survived the pregnancy itself. They've survived displacement, forced migration, conflict, hunger, and dangerous journeys to reach care. But then they do not survive childbirth itself. So a new three-part Lancet series that we just published about a few minutes ago now argues that most of these deaths should never happen in the first place. The series estimates that postpartum hemorrhage, that is excessive bleeding after childbirth, affects 27 million women, that is roughly one woman per second, and kills nearly 43,000 mothers every year, making it one of the leading direct cause of maternal death. But also very importantly, it has a huge cost to the society and health systems because it costs over $10 billion every year. And that does not include direct and indirect costs to families who have to pay out of pocket to seek care. But the tragedy in all of this is that we already know how to save these women. Today, many women are giving birth in some of the most challenging environments, as you know, because pregnancy doesn't stop during conflict. It doesn't stop during strife. So in displacement camps, in health, fragile health systems, in hospitals struggling with medicines and health workers, there are people presenting for care. But when a woman develops severe bleeding after birth, survival depends on speed, how quickly you can intervene. So the series frames postpartum hemorrhage as a race against time, and it tries to identify six critical delays that can determine whether a woman survives or lives, survives or dies, and how we can prevent these delays. So from diagnosis and treatment to escalation of care to access to blood products. Our series argues that one of the biggest obstacles is surprisingly simple. Up till now, a lot of healthcare settings around the world are still using guesswork to determine when a woman requires treatment. That is visually estimating blood loss, looking at the linen, the bed, the soap, whether they are soaked to a certain extent before they determine a woman has postpartum hemorrhage. That in itself should be a global scandal, because visual estimation of blood loss has been shown to miss up to half of postpartum hemorrhage cases, which means that a lot of women don't get treated when they should. But the problem is not only that too many women are missed when they have excessive bleeding, it's also that they are treated too late. And for decades, clinicians have typically had to wait for a woman to bleed up to half a liter of blood before they make that diagnosis and intervene. But the series evidence showed that treatment could actually begin sooner in some women who are at higher risk. If such women reach a threshold of blood loss of 300 milliliters of blood, but if that is accompanied by abnormal vital signs, which means that intervention can then begin before bleeding becomes catastrophic. But prevention of excessive bleeding after birth could start long before labor, before pregnancy itself. There are several things that we could do upstream to reduce that. So the series highlights several missed opportunities to reduce risk, including tackling anemia, for instance, before a woman gets pregnant and why she's pregnant. Expanding access to contraception. If we reduce unplanned pregnancy, unwanted pregnancy, then the complications that come with pregnancy are also much reduced. Reducing unnecessary cesarean sections. Cesarean section by default will lead to more bleeding after childbirth. And ensuring that every woman receives effective medicines, quality assured medicine, that can prevent excessive bleeding after birth, at the point of birth. Perhaps the most striking finding on this series is a simple treatment bundle that we call the Motive Bundle. This is a 5-in-1 emergency response bundle that can be given to a woman immediately that a diagnosis of postpartum hemorrhage is made. And this has been shown that if you identify a woman with postpartum hemorrhage early and you implement this 5-in-1 bundle, you could actually reduce progression to life-threatening bleeding and emergency surgery or death by up to 60%. And this approach has been designed in such a way that midwives and frontline health workers can act immediately. So you don't need a doctor or a specialist to review a woman before that treatment can be instituted. But I bring a message of hope. I think the important thing we need to be clear about here is that it's not just about bad numbers that the series is trying to project, but the message is that there's hope. We know how to deal with these issues, and there are solutions. We have the knowledge, we have the medicines, we know the tools that work. But the challenge is how to ensure that every woman, wherever they deliver, whether it's in Geneva or Goma or Kiev, that they survive pregnancy and that they have access to effective care to save their lives, because every minute counts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Femi. Very informative and educative. So thank you so very much for sharing this important information with us and on this series. So let's turn over to you, colleagues, if you have any questions. We do. Christiane, please.
Is this a question of money, providing money to healthcare systems in countries that don't have it? Or is this also a matter of health services in better equipped countries who don't seem to know well enough how to deal with this problem?
Thank you for that question. It's a lot of issues. Definitely money is a problem because we find out that the burden of the problem is mostly in countries that are struggling economically, but also the political will has to be strong. Sometimes many of these countries actually have money, but they do not dedicate enough resources to healthcare. And so what we found is political will is very important, and in places where there's strong political attention to addressing deaths from postpartum hemorrhage, we've actually seen a strong decline in postpartum hemorrhage deaths.
Thank you very much. Important angles. Let's see if there are further questions in the room, online. No, I think you are abundantly clear, and thank you again for this important information, this update, and please do come back sooner than the last time you were here, so thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Sena, would you like to join me here on the podium? So Sena is here to provide an update on the ongoing International Labour Conference, and you also have something about a media briefing. Yes. And then lastly, we'll have a short announcement on UNAIDS, but over to you, Sena.
Thank you very much. Yeah. There we go. All right. Good morning, colleagues. As some of you are aware, today is the last day of the International Labour Conference, which began on the 1st of June. And I'd like to share with you the outcomes of the discussions in the four committees that met throughout the conference. The committees are the Committee on the Application of Standards, on Gender Equality in the World of Work, on Social Dialogue, and on Decent Work and the Platform Economy. I'll start with the discussion on the gender equality at work. The committee did adopt a resolution and conclusions on the transformative agenda for gender equality in the world of work. And the conclusions acknowledge technological, environmental, and the demographic transitions that are reshaping the world of work. And the conclusions aim to provide a strategic roadmap to how to navigate these new challenges in order to ensure that the world of work is inclusive and equal when it comes to gender, and also to work towards building institutional capacity, enforcement mechanisms, and support with adoption of the right policies and legislations. The Committee on Social Dialogue and Tripartism was a reoccurrent discussion, and it focused on how to improve social dialogue, which is dialogue between employers, workers, and governments, and strengthen tripartism. Social dialogue and tripartism, of course, are key to democratic liberal governance. And the conference managed to adopt the conclusions. And the conclusions will hopefully provide guidance for ILO actions to support constituents in strengthening social dialogue in their respective countries. The Committee on the Application of Standards met, and they looked at 23 individual cases. There were special sittings on Belarus and Myanmar, and all resulting in conclusions. And last but not least, of course, is the Decent Work on Platform Economy. I am pleased to share that the committee approved a convention on decent work in the platform economy, and the convention will be submitted to a vote in this morning's plenary sitting in order for it to be officially adopted. And this convention aims to become the first globally binding labor standard specifically addressing work performed through digital labor platforms. As some of you are aware, because we communicated with you via email yesterday, we are also holding a media briefing via Zoom this afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Geneva local time with the members of the committee who led, as well as the ILO one of our leading ILO experts, to talk about the convention, explain what it includes, what it covers, and what it means to when it comes to work in the platform economy, otherwise known in some cases as the gig economy. And that's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Saina, for this important update. These important updates. Yeah, Robin.
Thank you. On the platform economy, could there still be amendments to this in the coming hours? And secondly, do we have an idea as to the timing, a bit more precision on the timing? Could it come? Will it definitely be before the briefing this afternoon, for example?
Thank you for the question, Robin. So, in principle, we expect for the text to be adopted as is, and the text is already available online. And the vote should be done by the time we meet this afternoon, because it has to be done. The ILC closes after the morning plenary sitting, and this is where the vote will happen.
Okay, well noted. Thank you, Saina. For the questions for Saina before we wrap. No, that's not the case. Good luck this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you. I should know that by now, shouldn't I? Thank you very much, Francois. Let me do that again. So, as I mentioned earlier, there is, just have a short announcement from UNAIDS. John, you had referred to this report. So today, in fact, UNAIDS did release the latest data on HIV following major disruptions in 2025. This was in a report that was issued to that effect, and this is days before the UN General Assembly high-level meeting on HIV/AIDS taking place 22-23 June in New York, when UN member states will come together to adopt a new political declaration on HIV to guide the response over the next 5 years, an important gathering. Of course, the report details the impacts of funding cuts and rollback on human rights and on the AIDS response, particularly on HIV prevention and community-led services. So you should have received all the embargoed materials. Sophie is online, as is Charlotte from UNAIDS. If you have any questions, you can raise your hands now, or otherwise you can connect with Sophie and or Charlotte afterwards. Again, you have the report at your disposal, so they're available to answer any questions you might have. I'm just giving it a second. Going once, going twice, no questions for the moment, so maybe do connect with them afterwards. Just a couple of statements I want to make sure that you are aware of. The statement that we shared with you last night from the Secretary General, this follows on the situation in the Middle East, one of a few statements that we've issued recently on the conflict in the Middle East, particularly, and the SG has once again expresses deep concern by the continuing escalation in the Middle East, including the strikes by the United States on Iran and the strikes by Iran on neighboring countries in the Gulf. So this is a statement that we shared with you after hours last night. And as always, the Secretary General is calling on the United States and Iran to redouble their efforts towards a peaceful, comprehensive, and durable agreement that advances regional and international peace and security. So do take a look at that statement. Another statement we shared with you is a statement from the Secretary General, once again, remarks, in fact, on the launch of the Muscat Plan of Action. For those of you not familiar with the Muscat Plan of Action, this is an initiative that is aimed at countering hate speech and help prevent genocide and atrocity crime. The plan highlights the roles of traditional and indigenous leaders in promoting peace and strengthening social cohesion. In his remarks, the Secretary General stressed that hate speech is a growing threat to peace and security, and he called for breaking this cycle through education, support for those targeted, and stronger action by governments and technology companies. Important statement that we shared with you last night. In terms of meetings, we have the Committee on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Members of their Family ending its session this afternoon in about an hour from now, around 12:30, at which time the final observations for the three reports that they reviewed this session, Ecuador, Gambia, and Ghana, will be shared with you. And as you well know, the Human Rights Council session, 62nd regular session, starts this coming Monday, the 15th of June. It lasts to the 7th of July. Lots of important discussions therein. You've seen the notes that Pascal and Matt have shared with you. The president of the council also briefed you on Wednesday to provide an insight to this important gathering starting next week. And that's it for me. Just to mention that, indeed, of course, we will be, despite all the measures being taken in terms of G7 starting next week, we will be open for business. We are reducing our footprint to an extent, but we will be having our briefing here on Tuesday. And so please feel free to join us. If you plan to come in over the weekend, do let me know. We're trying to minimize our footprint. You will be allowed access, but with the condition that you inform us and that you also inform security if you do plan to come. But of course, the idea is to minimize the number of people at the Palais, but we will be carrying on business as usual for next week during the G7. And I know many of you will be covering that. Many have asked the question. That's why I volunteered this information. So that's it for me. Any questions? I have one from Catherine. Go ahead, Catherine. We can't hear you. Sorry, Kat, we can't hear you. If you want maybe to connect with me afterwards or maybe drop your question in the chat very quickly before we wrap up. Or let me see, in the meantime, are there other questions we might have? No. Any information about logistics to find parking places Monday? I think by virtue of the fact the question is about parking on Monday, I think by virtue of the fact that we, the staff members, are reducing their footprint, where many only critical staff will be working, or staff who really need to be here will be instructed to come here. So that should free up a lot of spaces for Monday. Should you wish to come and park, I think it'll be a lot easier than perhaps other days. Even despite the fact that we have the Human Rights Council coming, we should have more spaces than usual. So thanks for that. Any further questions? No, that's not the case. So wishing you a nice weekend. Hopefully get some rest. See you here on Tuesday.